Okay, so this is Alicia Roche. Today is Thursday, June 21st, 2018. I am at 442 Warren Street. I am here as part of the Oral History Summer School recording an interview with Kamal Johnson. Kamal and I just met just 30 minutes ago, so we will begin our interview at this point. And Kamal, would you introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Kamal Johnson. I'm a community member here in Hudson, New York. I'm a city councilman. Do a ton of work with youth, and I'm happy to be here for this interview.
Good. Thank you for joining us. So it sounds like you do a lot here in the community. What got you interested in doing all of these different types of things?
Growing up, I had like a rough past. So, I was one of four boys. My mother was a single parent. My dad, died when I was around 4 years old. So, I looked through different programs for an outlet to dealing with, street life and things that I was seeing growing up around. Out of my brothers, I'm the only one out of the four that's never been to jail or prison and is not currently in jail or prison. So, growing up, I always saw like those were my options. Like, one day I'd probably be, killed or in jail or, something negative. So, working with youth, I received the chance to work with youth during a program that the Hudson High School was holding. And at that time, I was failing a bunch of classes. I wasn't on track to graduate. I was actually thinking of dropping out. And when I went to that class, they had a program where we were working with kids in the elementary school. And for some reason, the youth at that school just seemed to gravitate towards me. So I started thinking about, maybe like this could be a career for me. And, at that time growing up, like you're not really sure what your talents are. And no one had really told me that, I was talented or I was smart. So that was really like a wake up for me to see like maybe there is something there that I can use and hone, and that can become my talent.
So it sounds like you had to figure out a lot of this on your own. Or did you have mentors or people that you could point to that did reach out to you and support you?
I have two main mentors. One being an old gym teacher, Pat Malloy, who he always, no matter what was going on in my life, whether I was in trouble, whether I was doing good, he always was the same person. He never treated me different. He never approached me in any different way. He was always consistent, and that was something that kind of drew me to him. So whenever he would give me advice, I would take that advice like it was golden. And another mentor that I had was Todd Smith. He runs a local boxing club. And at the time when I met him when I was younger, it was in during the youth summer programs, and he was the only black director that we had ever seen. And the way he dressed, the way he talked, he, had his sneakers always matched his hats, and like he dressed like the kids of the neighborhood, and he talked like this. So he was like a direct representation of something that we could be. And he always used to tell me, when I get older, you're gonna take my spot in this, and like I'm gonna pass the baton to you. There's something like special in you. And I used to look at him like, like you crazy, like no way. But as I got older, he ended up being right, and I ended up taking his spot and being the director of that program, and that was like one of the changing points in my life.
So you talked about, you said that you had a difficult upbringing. Can you talk a little bit more about what your life looked like growing up? What are some of the things that you experienced, or just what did your day look like, for instance, as a child?
Yeah,
growing up here.
Growing up, like I said, my life was really like a roller coaster. Like I call it the storybook life. I lost my father when I was 4 years old. That was like a trying time that like I was struggling to understand. A lot of my brothers went to jail shortly after that for a number of years. My oldest brother, who's incarcerated currently, he went away for 9 years. So I lost him right after. My other brother that's right under him, he went to jail for 7 years. So it was kind of, you know, us and my mother. My mother fell into drugs really bad. So it was kind of like for a period, we didn't have parents. So we were raising each other. We were really rough kids. We came from a very violent background. You know, we idolized drug dealers and we idolized like gang members and people that lived off the street because that's, you know, what we saw. I didn't know any lawyers or doctors or teachers or anything like that. What I knew was the people with the nice cars are the ones that are breaking the law. And the reasons they're breaking the law is because they want to provide and there's no other opportunity to do that. So growing up, that's all I knew. My mom was, it was times where she wouldn't be home for weeks. And my brothers used to sit me down and say, like, listen, one day we might get this phone call that, you know, she's gone forever. You know, she's probably OD'd somewhere in the alley or, you know, killed. And we would always kind of prepare for that phone call. And I remember that was like the first time I realized that Santa Claus wasn't real, because I would always like wait for Christmas and I'd be like, all right, like for Christmas, like I just want my family. Like, you know, I just want that. And then when that wish never came true, I was like, man, this this Christmas stuff is a joke. Like the Santa Claus stuff is a joke. So that like leaves you to grow up fast. And I grew up with like a hole in my heart that I basically wanted revenge on the world and revenge for being born. And I realized even working with youth that a lot of kids have that same hole in their heart, and that's why like I can understand them. So my mother, when I got older and I got to high school, she sought help and she came home and she's been clean for a number of years. She bought a house and we moved out past the Hudson High School, and things really started to turn better. But I still had this chip on my shoulder, and it was hard for her to discipline us because she had been gone for so long. So it's like, what can you tell us? Like, we've been feeding ourselves, you know, we missed out on Halloweens and birthdays and all of this stuff. So there was always that resentment there too, no matter how hard she tried. Like, we still, like, we were what we had become, grown up to be already. And now, you know, my little brother, who I didn't want that life for him, so I always tried to steer him in the right direction. But he was something that I just couldn't control. And when I realized that, I really had to let him be the person that, you know, he wanted to be, because that would always, you know, hold me back. Because after helping so many kids, I wanted so bad to be this, the kid that, you know, I turned around and saw who he's going to be. So that's something like mentally for my own mindset, I just had to let him be who he wants to be and give up on that. But like, that's kind of why I say like my upbringing was like really bad. And in between all of that, there was like some things that happened, like our house burnt down and we were homeless for a period of time. And going to school is, when you're homeless, is probably worse than actually the thought of being homeless, because of the embarrassment that you have to feel. I remember going to school a day after my house burnt down and people saying like, oh, why can't we ever like go to your house? And at the time I'm living in a hotel. So, you know, you lie and you say different things just because you don't want to confront the truth of, you know, you're homeless and there's not much help for you. So now that street life is looking even more enticing.
So, in terms of school, what did that look like with teachers and administrators? What did that look like?
School was rough for me my early years because I wanted to live up to the expectation that I am the bad kid everybody says that I am. So I was the class clown. I used to get into fights. I used to just do like just the dumbest stuff, just being a kid and not caring because no one had ever told me why school is important. It was always just like get an education, and it's like get an education for what? Like what am I going to be able to do with this? I don't know anyone in my community or around me that's, you know, a light that I can look up to and say like, oh, okay, like this is the path that I should take. This is for me. And in the school district, there's no minority teachers or anything. So we don't have that. It's all white people there even. So it's like, there's still not that example. And I feel like the teachers that I grew up around, most of them, they didn't identify with the students that they were teaching. There was a few that tried their best, but the majority of them didn't get it. And when you grow up and no one tells you that you're smart, you don't think you're smart. I remember taking a test one time in history, and I remember looking around the room and saying like, damn, if I could like just borrow one of these white kids' brain just for this test, you know, just to get me out of here so I can pass, like that would be like the best thing ever. And in reality, like, I could be just as smart or smarter, but I just had no clue.
So you mentioned finding that light. How did you find the light to lead you to the path that where you turned things around for yourself?
Yeah, so when I went to school one day and I was really involved with this teacher, Miss Howe, who she had the class that we were working with the students in the elementary school. And she used to talk to me all the time and say, like, you know, you can do something better. Like, you have the personality, you have all these things, like, going for you. You can do so much better. And the way the students react to you, they're not reacting like that to anyone else in the class. So I remember at the time I was working at a catering place. And I always had jobs growing up because like I just always needed money for different things. So at the time, I went to the catering place and I was like, listen, I quit. And I didn't like working as a caterer. I like to cook, but when you work as a caterer, it takes literally your whole weekend. And as a, you know, 16, 17, 18-year-old, you need those weekends, you know, no matter how much money you're making. Like, if you can't spend it on the weekend, it means nothing. So I went there and I said, I quit. I'm going to go be a teacher. And like, he, like, laughed, but he said, like, yeah, like, you know, this is not for you. Like, you're good at this, but this is not who you are. And I think, like, you would be a great teacher. So I was like, you know, I'm going to be a teacher. And that was my goal, but I didn't know how. No one ever talked to me about college. Nobody ever talked to me about, you know, where my grades should be or what steps I should take. So I ended up talking to some of my friends in class. And this one girl told me, hey, I work at the after school program. And I see how you are with the kids in the elementary school. You should come and talk to my boss. So I was like, all right. So I went after school with her, and I sat down with Kathy Clark, who runs the after-school program here in Hudson at the school. And I just told her, you know, all of the things that I do and with the youth at the elementary school. And she was like, all right, you know, let's give you a shot. And I went there the first day, and I was just like, wow, like, this is for me. And I was able to like create programming myself, and a friend was already working there. One of my good friends, Vincent Hemingway, was working there already. So me and him instantly clicked, and we would like have competitions on who could create the best program, who could recruit the most kids. And I remember running into a bunch of the kids there and sitting them down when they get in trouble, and them having the same answers that I was telling teachers when I was in trouble. And for me, that I had to look in the mirror and say, like, wow, I really need to change, you know, some of the things that I'm doing if I'm going to be able to talk to them and they listen and realize that. So that was the first reflection that I had. So during that school year, it was senior year, I got a letter that I was taken off the graduation list, and I was failing 4 classes, and they said I wasn't going to graduate. So I remember saying, like, I really got to get myself in order if, because I don't want to go to this school again. So I remember I was sitting down in social studies, and I was taking a test, and I was kind of telling myself, like, I need to focus, like, I need to get out of school. So I applied myself, and I ended up getting the highest grade on the exam. So when I came back to class 2 days later, the teacher pulled me aside and she said, oh, how did you do it? And I was like, how did I do what? And she was like, how did you cheat on this test? So I said, what? So she was like, yeah, you got, you know, one of the highest grades, and, you know, that's a high jump from your previous test. And, I just want to know, like, just be honest with me. So I looked at her and I was like, I don't know if that's racist or what you're trying to say, but there's no way I cheated on this test. So she had like a practice exam on the blackboard, because a number of students, more than half the class, failed the test. So she wanted to give like some kind of curve. So where we were retaking it, if you answer the questions on the board, then you can higher your grade. So I got mad and I got up and I was like, you know what? I'm out of here. So I answered all the questions on the board and I left. And so I went down to the office and, you know, I went to detention, and I remember at the end of detention, the bell rung and I was about to go back to class, and the same teacher that told me I cheated showed up, and she said, I want to talk to you after school. And I was like, talk to me for what? So like, you could say more racist stuff, like, so you could say I cheated at the stuff that I put on the board. And I just told her in the hallway, I was like, all those were right, weren't they? Like, everything I put on the board was right. And she just walked away. So then after class, I was like, I'm not meeting with this lady, like, I'm leaving, like, this is a setup to get me in more trouble. So I started to walk out, and she kind of cut me off, and she was like, let me talk to you just for 5 minutes. And I sat down, and she was like, she handed me a packet, and I was like, what is this? I was like, I'm not doing any more tests for you. Like, I already did two and a half tests basically here. And she was like, just fill this out. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing it. And I was just like arguing with her back and forth. And then she like, it was like tough love, but like I felt it. But she just like, she looked at me and she was like, listen, shut up and fill this out. So like, I was just like, as a young punk kid, like upset that she told me to shut up. So I started filling out the test and then I handed it back to her. And then I left. And then when I came in that morning, she was waiting for me in the parking lot. And she told me, she was like, you know what that was that I gave you yesterday? And I was like, no, what? And she said, that was an entrance exam to a college. And she was like, you got like 85% on that. And I was like, really? And she was like, you can go to college. Like, you can like be something. And at the time, that was the first time I ever heard that. So I was just like, eh. Like, I was just more concerned with, yeah, see, I told you I didn't cheat. And she was like, do this for me. Apply yourself like you did for 2 weeks and let's see what happens at the end of the 2 weeks. So I did that and I got the highest grade on literally everything that we did. And like, part of who I am, I'm a presenter. So when we had presentations, I would like kill. And she was like so blown away, and I saw like my grade just go so high. Like, I was like always a 70s, 60s kid, so now I'm getting 80s and 90s, and I was just like, whoa. So I started applying myself to every class, and then I started like hearing people start to say like, oh, well, you know, you don't have to worry about that because you're smart. And I remember when I first heard that, I was like, wait, what? I was like, shit, like, I'm one of the smart kids now? I was like, wow. So then I would apply that to, like, the kids that, like, I felt like were nerdy in the class. And I would be like, nah, I'm smarter than this nerdy kid. Like, I'm gonna, like I want to see what's his grade. And, like, I, like, got super competitive because I never knew that I was smart. And it's funny now because people always refer to me like, no, you're like bright. So I got all my grades up and I got back on the graduation list, and then I graduated. So that was like my school career in a nutshell.
How did that feel when you realized what you had in you all along?
Confusing, because I didn't know what all of this meant, but I knew that I was becoming this person that people were using as a role model. Like, people used to start calling me a role model and a leader, and I remember just like, since when? And no longer did I have to live up to that bad kid role, because that wasn't me. So even when I would like do stuff or get in trouble, people would be like, come on, that's not you. And I'm like, what? Like, yes, that is me. Like, that was just me, you know, 6 months ago. But it almost wasn't believable anymore. And for myself, I started thinking and looking at some of the kids I was working with and saying, like, that's not me anymore. Like, that's not who I am. Like, I can be something different. And I remember, like, another one of the eye-opening times in my life, I went to, around that same time before my graduation, I went to see my oldest brother in jail. And he was just talking to me about all the like fights and things that he was going on, things going on in jail. And when he would be released, and he was like, you know, like, you know a lot of people, you're popular, you're smart, you got all these things going for you. Like, you know, now it's time for you to like really learn the game. And he was telling me, like, you know, I can teach you some stuff and you can get started small, but, like, it's in you. And I remember just thinking, like, at first, like, being like, yeah, like, this is, you know, what I've been waiting for. But then out of nowhere, I just started crying, like, right at the table. And that was the first time I had cried in probably 15, 16 years. And I just, like, just started crying. And my mom and my brother just looked at me like, what's going on? And I was like, I don't want to be like you. Like, I don't want to be like you at all. And I was like, I want different. And I think I grew up in that moment where I was just like, this is not what I want. Like, I don't want to be sitting across the table from someone in jail and like, I'm idolizing you and you have less than me. And I was just like, that's not what I want. And from then, I just told myself, I'm not going to ever go to jail. Like, I'm just not. And then I went home, and I went right to the books. I went right to getting focused and really applying myself and saying to myself, like, I'm better than, you know, my past, and I'm better than the so-called environment. And that kind of, like, stuck. Like, I always have to be that. And I remember that year, I was passing everything, but there was a big Regents test for math, and everyone in the state failed that test. And we had to speak out into the Board of Education meeting. And I remember being so frustrated after I put in all this work, like, I changed who I am, and now you're telling me because of a test I might not graduate. And I remember, like, being with my friends and, like, everybody else who was with me at that time at the meeting and saying to them, like, we didn't fail that test. Like, that test failed us. And you guys need to do something about this, because we worked hard for this. And if no one in the school passed it, then obviously that's a sign. And that was one of the first times, like, I was known for, like, having, like, a speech with, like, quotable things, and people would always say, like, no, you have to speak about this, and you have to do this, and that's where, like, people would say, like, you should run for mayor, you should run for office, you should do this, and I was just like, I don't know, I just kind of just yelled something out, and, like, it ended up being kind of good, but that was, like, a time when I realized, like, I have a talent. And that's when I found, like, what that talent was. Because growing up, you know, you either rap or you play a sport or anything like that. And you don't know, like, your talent could be anything.
So talk a little bit about what, after high school, what was your path like then in terms of education or work? What did that
After high school, like, I just barely made it out by the skin of my teeth, really buckling down, and my mom really pushing me to, like, that's a part that I definitely have to add, is that there was a time where I also dropped out, and my mom stopped going to work. She was like, if you're quitting, then I'm quitting too. And this was after the conversation that I had with my brother where I was crying in the prison. And she was like, I'm not going to let you give up. So she didn't go to work. And I was like, all right, like, I know you have days off, but, like, you're going to go to work tomorrow. So, but I'm not, you know, going back to school. Like, this is it. And so the next day came, and she didn't go again. So now I was getting kind of nervous because I'm like, all right, I'm going to finish this out. But once I finish high school, like, that's it. Because I didn't know anything else. So I was like, that's it. So she was like, just finish and see what happens after there. So I graduated, and it was kind of like a standstill when I was like, what now? Like, I was thinking about going to the Army. My father was a Vietnam vet. He was in the Army, but I also had, like, bad feelings about the service because he came home so messed up, and I would hear so many stories about, like, him being an alcoholic and him having all these nightmares and tremors and different things like that. So I was like, I don't want that to be me. Like, I'm proud that, like, he was a soldier, but also at the same time, I have enough issues. So I was like, what do I do now? And then a lot of my friends were going to the community college, Columbia Green. So I was like, you know what, let me just go there because everybody else is going there and see what happens. So I went to orientation. They were like, what do you want to do? And I had no clue. So I was like, yeah, I want to be a teacher. I was like, so again, I was, you know, with this teacher stuff. I was still working at the after school program. And I also was working with kids with behavioral difficulties at mental health at that time as well. Doing, like, one-on-one mentoring. So I was still, like, in that field with youth. So I was like, yeah, you know, let me see what happens. Like, maybe I'll end up a teacher. So my first day of Columbia Green, I'm thinking, all right, this is, like, going to be, like, 13th grade. I go in here, be a class clown, just skid by, and, you know, maybe end up with a degree. And my first class that I got to, I was the youngest person in the class and the only male. So it was all older women who, this was their second chance, so there was no playing around in here. Like, they were focused, they, like, were asking questions. Like, these are all, like, parents and women who really, like, they're here for a reason. So that was probably the first time I actually just had to sit down and learn for the entire class, because I didn't want to be that guy and hear it disrupting. And I remember leaving my first semester at Columbia Green with a 4.0. And I was just like, when I got the letter in the mail, I was like, wait, what? I was like, this is crazy. So from there, I held myself to a different standard now. So now it wasn't about earning, you know, 70s and 60s. Like, now I want A's. Like, I want to keep this level high. And I graduated from there. I got my associate's in adolescent education. And then I transferred to New Paltz. And I went to SUNY New Paltz. And my first day there, I remember sitting in the hallway and people just coming up to me speaking and introducing themselves and me being like, where the hell am I and how did I get here? And I just applied myself and I focused. And through my halfway through my first semester, I remember just sitting there and I'm just like, man, like, I don't know how I got here, but like, I really, like, there's a bigger picture for me. And at that time, I got an offer from the after school program to get a promotion where I wasn't going to be a staff anymore, but they wanted me to run the program. And the same with the summer program. They wanted me to be the director there. So I went and talked to Todd, and he was like, I told you. And I was just like, yo, this is crazy. Like, I'm the director here. Like, I couldn't believe it. And that was really, like, a big point for me where a lot of kids started looking up to me. And I remember one black kid saw me at the corner store on First Street, and he said, KK, and that's what, like, people around the town call me, KK. And they said, KK, what are you doing down here? I was like, what do you mean, what am I doing down here? He was like, why are you, like, in this store? I was like, I live around the corner. And they were like, wait, what? And I was like, yeah. And then I realized, like, wow, like, they've never seen anyone in their school that's their color, talks like them, looks like them, lives around them, that's, you know, as a professional. And I just started saying to myself, like, you know, I don't need to sell drugs. Like, I don't need to do all these things. And, like, I was able to get a lot of things that I was seeing the drug dealers get. Like, I have a nice car. I have nice things in my home. But I was able to do that legally. And, you know, that was something that I was very proud of.
So, what did it mean to you to realize that you were a role model to other children?
I didn't want to be a role model. I just wanted to kind of groom the next me. Like, I wanted people to be able to get to where I'm at so that they can see farther. Because I thought I had hit my ceiling at that time. So I was like, you know, I was content. Like, all right, I'm making, you know, a salary that at the time I thought was good, but when I look back, like, it wasn't good at all. So I was, like, just so happy to do what I love doing that I didn't care about money or anything like that. So my thing was, like, if you can get to where I'm at, you're in good shape, then you can go anywhere after that. And so, like, I didn't really think about what it meant to be a role model. I just wanted to make sure that I was making the right decisions for my own life so that people could say, like, all right, I can get to that point. Like, he's the bar. I gotta pass that.
So, I know you mentioned one of your roles. Currently, you're alderman. So, can you talk a little bit about how you got from being a director and an after-school program to participating in politics?
Yeah. So, part of my role, like, it's the transition kind of played itself out. People would tell me all the time, like, you should get into politics. Whenever something would happen in the city, people would say, you need to speak up. And when I noticed when I speak, people listen. So I would host a ton of events, community discussions and different things like that. People would say, yo, can you be a part of this? And I would always do a great job. Like, I'm a speech writer. That's one of my talents. And I remember being in the crowd one day. There was a State of the Community that I was hosting, and I would watch every speaker, and I would watch everyone, like, in the crowd and their reactions and who's paying attention, who's not, who's reacting to certain things, and who's upset. And that would really be, like, my guide on how I have to approach this crowd. And I remember just looking at everyone speak, and I wanted to be better than each person that spoke. I was like, all right, so, like, I have to go out here and I would have to hit it out the park. And I would do it every time. So it really like became like a part of me to speak for the community and to speak for people that didn't have a voice. So I helped grow this organization called the Greater Hudson Promise Neighborhood. I was there since, you know, the beginning, and they never had enough funding to keep me full time, so I would always come in these part-time positions and do different work with them, but that was always like where my heart was. And the youth center, of course, was you know, the other part of where my heart was. So I walked into the youth center, I want to say a year ago, a little over a year ago, after not being there for a couple of years, and I looked around and it was just falling apart. And I saw like kids playing, and there was like chocolate milk spilled across the table, and the kids are like playing in this, like it was like a stream. And like, and I remember seeing the floor was like, paint was chipped all over, like it just looked at like a place where you should not be. And I remember thinking like, these are the places that saved my life. So a lot of these kids here, they have similar stories than me, and this is what we're showing them. So I remember speaking out and saying, like, I went to Facebook and I said, and I put up the pictures and I showed them everything that I just explained. And I said, you know, is this the city telling us we don't care about the youth? And a lot of people got upset. A lot of people were for me, and a lot of people got upset. And I went to the different council meetings and I spoke and I said, this is ridiculous. And they said, well, you have great ideals, but you're not a part of the conversation, you're not at the table, you're not in the rooms when these things are decided. It's different. And I remember, I don't remember the gentleman's name, but he said it's different when you're on this side of the room. And so I said, okay, I'll get on that side of the room. And I ran my first campaign. I was a minority campaigning in a ward that is 5%, I think, minority, and predominantly, you know, white. And the two people I was running against had a history in politics. One was the incumbent. He was a longtime incumbent. So people counted me out right away. And I just remember saying, whenever someone would ask me, I'd be like, yeah, you know, I'm the front runner right now. Even though like everybody's like counting me out, I was like, I'm the front runner right now. But I knew right away, if they let me speak, there's no way people cannot vote for me. And I threw like community events, because this was something that people have told me for years, you should run for office. So I've been planning this my whole life. And I said, I'm not going to do hot dogs on the corner and shake people's hands and say, hey, come on, vote for me, and give them a hot dog. I didn't want to do that. I said, let's have real discussions and let's talk about the things people don't want to talk about. And that's what I did. And my first event was about the DRI, the revitalization grant that Cuomo gave the city. And that was something that I invited all the powers that be along with the community. We had it outside of City Hall, and I moderated the entire thing. And seeing the elected officials outside of City Hall, out of their comfort zone, I think a lot of people said, you know what, this might be our guy. And then I went to, I also do a radio show, and I gave a speech on that radio show where I did, like, it's probably one of the most amazing speeches I ever did. But I basically talked about America in the form of, like, a car. And when I did that analogy, I think that's when I captured the most people. And I knew, I was like, there's no way I'm going to lose this. And, you know, I won.
Well, tell me the analogy. What was the analogy?
So, basically, I said, you know, being an American is like owning a used car and it being your first car, buying it used. And I said, you know, you buy this car, it's new to you, but it has some history. You might know some of that history, but you don't know all of it. It's hard for you to understand, but it's still your car, you're excited, it's brand new, you probably spent your income tax to get it, so, or whatever, like, and in that first month, you're getting it washed every day, you have the little tree hanging up so everything smells good, you're excited, and then you start to have some history with this car. So then, as you go through your almost a year with your new car, and it's time for an inspection. And right before the inspection, the worst thing that happens to a lot of people, is that your check engine light comes on. So at this time, you're like, wow, I haven't even had this car a year yet. You know, I can't believe this. So you don't want to know what that problem is. You know that internally there's an issue, but it could be expensive. It could be hard to fix. It could be easy. But that fear is in you that you don't know. But you know there's a problem internally. You just don't want to look at it. So at first you ignore it because, you know, you don't have to go for an inspection yet for maybe another month. So someone gets in your car and they're like, hey, you know, your check engine light is on. And you look at them and, like, you're no longer worried about it being on. Now you're frustrated. So you say, like, yeah, I'm driving this every day. Like, we're getting from point A to B. Like, we're still going, car's still working, like, don't worry about it. So you leave that light on. It's getting closer now to your inspection. So you go to the local mechanic or whoever tells you, you know, hey, turn the battery off, or just do little tips that can clear the check engine light. So you do that. Check engine light clears. Now you go through inspection, you pass. You think all is well. But really, there's still that problem internally that you never checked. So, of course, that light comes back on to remind you there's something here that's an issue that you need to get checked. Your tires are fine. Everything's still going. You're driving the car. Everything's fine. And then one day, you go to get in that car and it doesn't start anymore. So now you're like, what's going on? Like, so you take it to the mechanic. And the mechanic tells you, like, didn't you notice your check engine light was on all this time? And that's a lot of what happens in our communities. We don't check our check engine light. We band-aid it and we flip the battery off to get it cleared. But instead, we're afraid that there could be a big issue and it could be expensive and it could be something that's going to take time and money and we won't look at it. We'd rather do something to get us our sticker so that we keep going throughout the life. And that's what happens. And that, kind of in a nutshell, was my analogy.
So you used that in one of your speeches, and mm-hmm. And then the election happened. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I remember at the primaries, and I was doing a bunch of speeches and a bunch of radio talks and different things like that, and I just got a new job working for like a higher position, and so I was away in Virginia at a training, and I got a call from a gentleman who said, is this Kamal Johnson? And I was like, yes, like, who is this? Like, is it a bill collector or anything? And he was like, no, I saw on YouTube your talk, one of your talks that you had, the community conversation, and he was like, I was impressed. And he said, one of the things that stuck out for me was that you said you can bridge the gaps between both worlds. Like you said, you go get a sandwich from First Street Store, and then you go right across the street and get a lavender lemonade from Verdigris. And I was like, yeah, and that's actually like a true story. And he was like, yeah, that stuck out to me. So what I want to do is I want to help you. I live in your ward. And I was like, well, right now, I mean, all you can do to help me is just get the word out about me. And he was like, well, I want to write you a check. And I was like, well, I don't really need any money right now because the election is literally 5 days away. And he was like, well, we got to do something to get the word out more. So I was like, you know, just reach back out to me. I'll be back in town in 2 days and we can go from there. So when I got back in the town 2 days later, he had purchased a ton of flyers and cards about the election, about me, the things I stood for. I don't know where he got these pictures. He like found them on like my Facebook or something. And I had an event a day before the election, and that was actually the first time I met that gentleman in person. And he came up to me, and I didn't know what he looked like or anything. I just knew his name. And I remember after the event, like, there was like a few people left, everybody shaking hands and me being worn out. And I just see like an older white gentleman walking towards me, and I looked up and I was like, "Mike?" And he was just smiling, and I was like, "Are you the guy?" And he was like, yeah, this was great. And I just thanked him, and I was like, wow, you know, like, we might have something here. And so an election night comes, win the primary. So myself and another gentleman are on the card as Democrats. I also, during that time, got endorsed by all the other parties. And that was another one of my plans, to really get my name out here, because I was this newcomer. I was a minority in a predominantly white ward. So I got the Republican endorsement, the Democrats, working families, the conservatives. I had them all across the board. So like, when I won the primary, I was like, all right, so this is a good chance now. But still, like, I was still nervous, because like, I've never ran a campaign before. And I was doing this pretty much with like two of my friends, where we were just like sitting in my living room, like, all right, what's our next step? Like, what can we do? And election night came, and everybody was kind of like telling me, like, it looks good, it looks good, it looks good. And when the numbers came out, I remember like we had a super high amount of votes for that ward, like over like 300. And, you know, I won. And I just remember being like, wow, like, add this to the resume. But still inside of me, I still had like that chip after seeing the youth center in that state. So I was like, let's get to work now. And that's where I'm at now.
So what do you think connected, sounds like a diverse group of constituents, what do you think connected them to you, or why do they feel connected to your message? What are some things that you feel like helped with that?
Because I think that the other candidates from the past haven't really, like, once they got elected, they became disconnected from the community and from the people. So I would see a lot of candidates talking more than listening, and that was my thing. I want to hear from, you know, the constituents. Like, I want to hear from the people. There's things that you guys know I care about, like the youth, and like, I want better police community relations, and those are things that I'm speaking strongly about. And I want to chair the youth committee. I want to chair the police committee. Like, I want to have the conversations that people don't want to have, because they don't want to offend certain people. They don't want to go against the status quo. And I think people saw that as, like, that's what's needed right now. Like, he's not afraid to put himself out there. I don't care what people say about me as far as, like, me speaking for what's right. So, like, I don't have that fear of, like, oh, well, this guy's family I've known for whatever years, like, if you're not doing right by the community, get out the way. And that's like where, like, my angle was to listen. So I would, you know, basically told my constituents, there's things, a lot of things that I don't know, but this is your chance to grow me into the candidate and into the person that you want to represent you. So when it comes to housing, then when it comes to preservation of the city, those are a lot of things that I didn't know about at the time, but I'm only going to know unless I sit down and I listen to what you got to say and what you guys also care about, because I'm also in a ward where we have all the youth programs, but there's not a lot of families. So what I care about is a lot different than what my ward cares about. So I really had to convince them, like, this is, you know, your chance to grow a candidate that you can trust. And it worked, and I've stuck by that.
So, as alderman, what is a typical day like for you?
At first, it was really easy. We just go in, we sit down, we vote for stuff, say yay or nay. Nothing big was happening. And it was the honeymoon phase, so all the other councilmen were like getting along, everybody's great. But now we've had, some big things that are happening, and I'm really fighting for this youth center to be what I know it can be. So I've had to put myself out there, and that's stressful. And it's stressful when, you're walking and you're trying to just shop at Walmart or wherever, and people want to tell you about politics and about different things like that. And you just want to buy your pork chops. And so, but that's part of the territory. And then there's reasons where it's stressful, but I realize like I'm the person that needs to be in this position. Like we just had a murder a couple days ago. And the last time we had something like this happen, I remember going to the meeting and one of the gentlemen kind of saying to a grandmother who had just lost their grandson, I know what it feels like. My cousin was killed and shot in the head, and I'm really saying they're like, okay, like you don't know what it feels like to be a grandmother and lose a grandkid. Like, so that's not inappropriate. Like, what you should be saying to that grandmother is, I'm sorry this has happened to you, and like we're going to do better as a community, and be patient and like really console her instead of trying to basically one up her or say like, oh, we're just the same when we're not the same. Everybody handles grief and struggle differently. And like when we just had this young man who's 19 that passed away a couple days ago, I'm fully comfortable in handling this meeting that's coming up next week because I was able to see it done wrong for so many years that I realized this is where I should be handling this.
So, in terms of organizing community members around these issues, tell me about that here locally.
Yeah, for me, it's easy to organize people because I volunteered for so many things. And I do a radio show along with two of my friends that's like really popular in the community. So whenever there's a tragedy or something happens, we're right on the front line. So people trust me. And they'd look for, me to tell them like the direction that we should go. And whenever something happens or a program is looking for help, like I'm always right on the front lines, and I don't get paid for that type of stuff. That's stuff that I just do because it's the right thing. And I don't know if this program could save me like other programs, save other people like the programs I went through saved me. So when I say like this is important, people show up because they know that I've shown up for them a million times. This community is tough though because this is a community that feels like they've been silenced. So, if you're working two, three jobs, you don't want to come to a meeting at 6 o'clock. You don't want to sit there. And then a lot of times they have come through to meetings, but nothing's happened after. People told them what they wanted to hear, and then they were stuck with the same bad results. So they're turned off, like, I don't want to do this. And that's why I really had to get in the door to be a part of this process to show them, like, no, this time, like, we're going to be in here until it's fixed.
So, what does the partnership landscape look like here? So, if there are organizations or people that you can reach out to help with what you talked about in terms of getting people to feel like their voices are being heard, tell me about that partnership landscape here.
Yeah, there's a lot of programs that are trusted in the community, like Promised Neighborhood, Kites Nest, different efforts like that, where they know that the people want what's best for them. There's also a lot of silos. There's the school district, there's the police force, there's all of these entities that are supposed to make up a community together, but instead they're seen as separate. And that's what makes it tough, because they'll say, like, oh, that's a city problem, that's not a school problem. And these are all the same youth and all the same families that are attending all these things. So the partnerships are important. I mean, I'm a part of a partnership with all the after-school programs and youth providers in the entire city. And during that, you know, they're discussing, like, what's best for families, what each program can bring to the table and what they can't. And I think that's extremely important when we have a changing city where families aren't welcome. And you can, and it's evident. So people are scared, and that was the main problem with the DRI, was that there was a lack of transparency. So when people are losing their apartments to bed and breakfast and to just raising super high rent, and now they see this $10 million grant where it's like all about tourism, it seems, people are like, this is it. Like, this is where, you know, the family die in Hudson. You know, you're gonna be in a town 10 miles away somewhere, or you're gonna be in Albany up there in that area, because you can't afford to live where your family has roots at that. So partnerships are very important, but it's about getting past egos and greed and everything like that. So it's really about just partnering with people in the community that are willing to put themselves on the line, that don't represent an agency or don't represent anything, so that they can speak freely without fearing retaliation or anything.
So you mentioned people feeling as if their option is to leave. What are some other ways that people, community members, that feel like their voices aren't being heard or they're being pushed out? What are some other ways have you seen people cope with what's happening?
I mean, the lack of jobs in the area, housing, the lack of housing. We had a summer, last summer, where there was a ton of violence. You know, over a span of like 3 weeks, I want to say there was 8 shootings. And those shootings, you know, 2 toddlers were injured, they were shot, a person died. So when there's a lack of resources and a city that's given the impression that they don't care because these are not the tourism money people, it's frustrating, and it really leaves people feeling defeated. And I think that's where we are now, where we have a youth center, and if you read the newspaper today, they show the different departments. And the way they spun this conversation was that the youth center is the third highest budget in the city. So people are like, well, the youth center is the third highest budget in the city. Like, why is everybody so worried about that? Maybe they need to look for different ways to spend the money. But if you actually look at the numbers, the first two are the Department of Public Works, which is over $2 million. The Hudson Police Department, which is almost at $3 million. And then the third highest is the youth center at $350,000. So, like, it's the third highest, but that's a big discrepancy. Like, that's huge. And that's the one thing that's directly affecting families. That's the one thing where the youth have somewhere to go after school between those hours of 3 and 7.
So I want to wrap up with a question. Thinking about your story and hearing about what it was like for Kamal as a young child, and now Kamal, the alderman and activist, and you can choose whichever direction you want to have this conversation, but what do you think Kamal, the little boy, will say to Kamal, the man you are now, or the man you are now, talking to Kamal?
Yeah, I always have this conversation, like, with myself, where I think that about that same question, and I just wish, my life isn't perfect. Like, I still deal with, like, a lot of trials and tribulations and stress and different things like that, but I just wish I can drive past that little boy and, like, roll the windows down in my nice car and say to him, just keep pushing. Like, I don't even want to give him tips and different things like that that I wish I can change. Like, I just want to say to him, like, it's going to be cool. Like, keep your head up and drive off. Like, I would change a lot of things if I could, but if I can only get one sentence out, I would say, just be cool, keep your head up.
Thank you, Kamal, for taking the time.
No problem.
All right.